Okay, so we are on page 42 of The Moon's Lost Light. And what's today? The 11th of November. Marilyn, do you want to start reading?
Yes. However, there is a difference in the starting points of different souls. Some people have souls that emanate from a higher point, while others have souls that emanate from a lower point. Those whose souls are higher must teach and influence those whose souls are lower, with these then handing down the influence to those whose souls are beneath them, etc. Those influencing are called male, while those receiving influence are called female. This is the Jewish idea of hierarchy, to give over God's teaching to those beneath and thereby raise them to a higher level.
Let's look at that for a minute.
Yeah. So why does it have to be male to female? Why can't it be female higher?
How does one know?
Yeah. Well, male is the concept of giving, and female is the concept of receiving.
So it's the male soul that's higher?
Well, so let's just see if it means that a male soul is in a male body.
So 108 is from Spasemis. Quote, and so there are always levels, and everyone must bless the one beneath him until all are attached to the upper root.
Okay. And I don't think it's totally clear that a male soul and the... I mean, I just don't know. So I'm just leaving that question. But we do have the concept of giving and receiving, and the male energy is that of giving. That's why we refer to God usually in the masculine, because God is the giver, and we refer to all humanity in the feminine, or all Israel in the feminine, as the receiver. So whether a Jew is male or female, in that sense they're referred to as the feminine, because they receive from God. So there's different types of giving and receiving and different types of masculine and feminine energies.
In the future, however, after all the sins are rectified and evil no longer exists, the circle situation will return. All those who serve God will be equal, with no need for one to learn from the other. God's presence will be seen equally in all the worlds, so there will no longer be higher souls and lower souls, and the aspect of male influencer versus female influenced will disappear. So,
right. So whatever that means. Yeah.
The Ma'or V'Shemesh then continues, this is the meaning of Hakafos, circle dances, that we do in Hoshanah Rabbah and Shemini Atzeret. We do circle dances according to the secret of Nekevia Tisovev Gever. A female will encircle a man, in order to draw down through these circle dances the upper light where there is no aspect of male and female. This was the intention of Miriam the prophetess, who took out all the women after her and made with them circle dances according to the secret of
Nekeva.
Nekeva to Sovet. What, can you just tell me what that means again?
Nekeva. Yeah, it's feminine.
Okay.
Surrounds.
Okay.
Masculine.
Okay, so or feminine surrounds masculine.
Yeah. Okay. Gever is really gentleman. It means man, but it's from the word gevura, also strength.
Okay, strength.
My Sephardic rabbi, Rabbi Avitan in Long Beach, used to say, "What? How can you tell who's a real man? A real gever is gimel bet resh. He's gomel chesed, vayshan rachman. He does acts of kindness. He's reticent and he's merciful." And that's a definition of a real... A real gever is gomel chesed by Shan Rahman. So,
nice.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll go back. This was the intention of Miriam the prophetess, who took out all the women after her and made with them circle dances according to the secret of Nekeva, the Soviet gever, in order to draw down the upper light where there is no aspect of male and female. Although the commentaries quoted give slightly differing translations of the phrase Nekeva Tisovev Gever, they all make the same statement, that in the future, men and women will possess equal spiritual perception. The question is, at what point in the future is this to take place? The Ma'or V'Shemesh describes a situation which will exist only after the complete rectification of the world. And the Kli Yakar in his commentary on the first verse of Az Yashir connects Nekeva to Soviet Geber to Techias Hamisim, the revival of the dead. We should probably look up.
Yeah. Note 109.
Mm-hmm. Our sages say that a maidservant saw at the sea what Yehezkel did not see. The prophet Yehezkel had a vision of God's heavenly host and his throne of glory, but the maidservant at the sea had a heavenly vision greater than this. And what is the connection of this song to the revival of the dead? Just as in the world to come, all will be disconnected from the material, and then males and females are equal, so at the sea, a maidservant saw the light of the glory of God, sort of an example of what will be in the future, as it says, Nikeva to Sover Geber, Sover Geber.
So Azishir is connected to Tres and Mesim in that in both instances, males and females were equal in their, will be or were equal in their vision of God, in their connection to the divine.
At the same time, Rabbi Yochanan ben Uziel, whose commentary is based on the prophet's own explanations, does not connect the Keva to Soviet Geber with prophecy, but with Torah study. Although he gives no time frame for this, the 31st chapter of Yirmiyahu, where the verse appears, is speaking not about the world to come or the return to the Garden of Eden, but about the ingathering of the exiles to the land of Israel. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Uziel says that Yeshayahu's prophecy, quote, the light of the moon will be as the light of the sun, will take place on the day that Hashem will return the exile of his nation.
Yeah, that's a long one too. Wow.
Alright, you want to read that one?
Sure. Read that one. I'll read that one. Okay. Targum Yonasan and Yeshayahu 30:26. The verse continues that the light of the sun will be seven times as great as on the 7 days of creation. This raises two questions. First, does this mean that the moon's light will be as great as the sun's light is now, while the sun's light will become even greater? If so, this implies that even after the redemption, although women will have the light of Torah, they will still have less spiritual perception than men. Second, the verse is obviously describing miraculous events, so how can this be related to our times? As for the first question, the Kli Yakar and others say specifically that women will be equal with men. Then males and females are equal, Kli Yakar 15:1. Moreover, we have already shown that after the rectification, everything will return to be as it was before the sin. And before the sin, man and woman were equal. As the Midrash says of the sun and the moon, they were created equal. If in the future men will have much more light than women, this is not a return to the original state. This is spoken of specifically in the Ma'or V'Shemesh, Part 1, on Shabbos Rosh Chodesh, which says of the eventual rectification of the moon's diminution, but in the future the earth will be filled with the knowledge of Hashem. The sun and the moon will shine down to people, and they will merit to see the lights equally as they were when originally created. This clearly shows that in Messianic times the sun's light and the moon's light will be equal. The Ma'or V'Shemesh connects this with male and female aspects of Hashem, but this parallels man and woman. For man was created parallel to Hashem's male aspect and woman parallel to Hashem's female aspect, as the verse says, and Hashem created the Adam in his image and form, male and female he created them. Therefore it follows logically that when the light of the sun and the light of the moon will be seen equally as they were at creation, as the Ma'or V'Shemesh says, then man's and woman's light will also be equal. I also remember seeing that in the future there will be two kings with one crown, and the malachos will be forbidden on Rosh Chodesh as on Shabbos, again showing equality of female with male. Right. So now Rosh Chodesh, which is a female holiday, you're allowed to do most things. You're not supposed to do laundry. You're not supposed to sew. You're supposed to have an extra nice meal. You're supposed to wear prettier clothes. But it's not like Shabbos, where it's all obligations. And it's not as many obligations. As for the second question, isn't the verse referring to miraculous... As we've already mentioned, the Arizal explained that Nekevatus of Evgever represents equality, for the circle is the symbol of equality, as explained in the Mor V'Shemesh quoted in the text. This too shows that woman, will not only return to her original greatness, but also that men and women will be equal. So apparently the verse means that the light of the moon will become as the light of the sun after it is increased. As for the second question, isn't the verse referring to miraculous rather than natural events? Yes, it is, but the beginning of the redemptive changes are natural and then become miraculous, as explained afterwards. since the light of the moon becoming as the light of the sun is intrinsically connected to the return of the Jews from exile, it is understandable that both would follow the same rules. All this, however, is only if everything is done in accordance with Torah. Otherwise, even though the powers of redemption are already influencing the world, the redemption itself is further delayed. In practical fact, this means that when the powers of redemption are not used according to Torah, they come out in a negative way, and Mashiach and the true and complete miraculous salvation do not yet come. I wonder what that means for today in terms of how we're using this energy.
Well, it must be partial good use, because there is the ingathering. There are Jews coming back to the land, which is important, but it's not complete.
Right, but that could be, the ingathering could be the energy of redemption that starts out naturally and has to be finished
miraculously,
but it could be that we're not using it correctly. Like with it, I mean, maybe with the ingathering we're supposed to be doing different things once we're in the state and there's so many Jews there, so that we're not using the ingathering correctly, we're just using it to liot.
To
be a nation like every other nation.
Yeah.
Well, there are Zionists who feel like we should be a nation like every other nation. It's not about Jewish exceptionalism.
Right.
It's about making us unexceptional.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that would be a negative use of the ingathering, just to say, okay, here we are. Let's just have an army. We'll have supermarkets. We'll have soccer games. And we'll be like everybody else. So that would be an incorrect use of the energy of the gathering, because now you have a critical mass of people, so now you can have soccer games and Olympic teams and a beauty pageant. You know, I mean, I read in the foreword about Miss Israel, who did not make it to Miss Universe. Mm. She didn't even make it into the semifinals.
Oh, dear.
Right, so, but everybody still claims her and still loves her, and because she's Jewish and because she's ours and blah, blah, blah. But I was thinking, like, is that really something we should be proud of? That she, like, that there was a swimsuit contest and an evening gown contest, and that we paraded our girl on stage naked in front of the world, that everybody should judge who has the best body? Like, really? That's, like, what we want?
Yeah.
You know? So we are a nation like every other nation, so we enter a girl in a beauty contest. You know, really, we should say, no, that's not how we do it. Sorry. You know? We Jews don't go parading our bodies around in public. That's not what makes us into Miss World or Miss Universe. So it could just be that's the misuse of the ingathering. And particularly ingathering, we have a beautiful Ethiopian girl. So that is absolutely emblematic of ingathering.
Wasn't she the one, Miss Israel?
She is Miss Israel,
yeah,
that's what I'm saying.
She's Somali, or Ethiopian.
Ethiopian, yeah.
Right. She's gorgeous. Yes,
yeah, she is gorgeous. So here we have a representation of the ingathering of the exiles.
Right.
And look how we used it.
Reduced to such a...
Yeah.
Hmm.
Okay, back to you.
All right, so at the same time...
Indeed.
In the period when millions of Jews have returned to live in the land of Israel, the situation Rabbi Yonasan ben Uziel predicted has begun to materialize, as women have, in fact, begun to learn Torah. We no longer see the marked distinction between the levels of abstract spiritual perception of men and women that were described by earlier generations. Furthermore, in society and marriage, women have also become much more equal, yet the redemption has not yet come. And ironically, their Torah study is somewhat disconnected from holiness.
We see some women's Torah study that is disconnected from holiness. I mean,
so what does that mean?
I find it fascinating. I mean, I definitely see women who are scholars who they're not shining lights.
Mm.
You know, like that they wear whatever floppy clothes. They, you know, they're just like part of they're learning Torah like for their PhD, or they're getting a PhD in learning Torah, but it's the same as learning, it's the same as studying for your PhD. They're intellectual, they're capable, they may be brilliant, but their Torah learning is academic.
Hmm.
It's not about transforming them. I mean, you see men who are like that too, but you certainly see women who are like that. Great brains, but they might as well be studying biology. It's the same thing.
Hmm.
You know, it's not
taken within and
it's not leading to holiness.
Yeah.
It's not leading to holiness. And it's not about them shining holiness in the world. And their students aren't about building holiness. They're about understanding how the Gemara works.
Right.
Right? So we definitely see that. You know, Torah says, and sometimes, but it's not always. There are women who are learning and really, really growing and really shining, but there is Torah study that's sometimes disconnected from holiness.
How are we to understand that powers of the redemption can appear without the redemption and without holiness? In order to answer this question, we must first understand something about the period before the coming of redemption called Ikvisa de Mashiach, the footsteps of the Mashiach.
So Ikvisa de Mashiach. That's Aramaic.
Ikvisa de Mashiach. Oh, okay.
Right. So it's Aramaic. It's the footsteps of Mashiach. So de is Aramaic, it would be she if it's Hebrew. And the at the end, like ima, abba, because in Hebrew it's ava'im. Right, so the at the end is also indicative of the Aramaic.
Okay,
so now we'll take a detour into learning about the dawn of redemption, the ikvisa de Mashiach. Want to read this part for us, Esther?
The dawn of redemption. About 200 years ago, Rabbi Hillel Sklaver, student of the renowned Vilna Gaon, authored a book on the first stage of the redemption called Kol HaTor. The words Kol HaTor, literally the voice of the dove, are part of a verse in Shir HaShirim. The buds are seen in the land, the time of the singing bird has arrived, and the voice of the dove is heard in our land. According to Kol HaTor, the voice of the dove alludes to Mashiach ben Yosef, who prepares the way for the main Redeemer, Mashiach ben David. According to Rabbi Hillel, the entire book is based on what the great master and Kabbalist, the Vilna Gaon, taught him and his other students before they embarked for the Holy Land as part of a plan to bring the redemption.
Yeah, stop there for a second. Yeah? Do you want to read the note?
Kol HaTor, page 20, Yosef Rivlin, editor?
Edition.
Mm-hmm. And about all the stages of the beginning of the redemption, he, the Vilna Gaon, also known as the Gra, revealed to many of his students who promised faithfully to go up to Zion and to practically start the work of the ingathering of the exiles by arousal from below with heavenly help. And on page 97, all the students of the Gra that promised faithfully to go up to our Holy Land and to devote themselves to the settling of the Holy Land. Our rabbi, the Gra, revealed to them from the secrets of the ways of the beginning of the redemption, according to the secret of the things to do, the times to do them, and those who should do them.
So the Vilna Gaon sent a group of students to Eretz Yisrael to create an awakening from below. So we have these concepts of, I think it's called Hisarusa de la Ela and Hisarusa de la Tata. Right, so his arusa, you can hear lehit arer in there. His arusa, hit arerut, his arusa, is Aramaic. So it's an awakening from above and an awakening from below. And there's different ways to create awakenings. So, and I think even in the Zionists, I mean, this is where you could see them doing things not from a source of kedusha, but the whole Zionist concept of avodah ivrit, right? There should be Jewish labor. That there was a sanctity in working the land yourself. You're not hiring Arabs to pick your olives. Like, we will do this. This is going to be Jewish labor that picks these olives, because there was a concept of it got divorced. By the time it was the pioneers, really, it got divorced from these sparks of holiness. But the Vilna Gaon students who were sent to create an awakening from below, which means engaging in physical stuff. You know, that just goes into Taya's question earlier, like, what kind of an offering is barley, right? It's not about an offering. It's about what physical thing are you doing to create the spiritual closeness that you want to create. So how do you do something physical to create the awakening that you want? So he told them how to do it.
But, you know, isn't that sort of contrary to, what some of the ultra-Orthodox believe, the Satmars, people like that, that it's not the move toward redemption is not necessarily man engendered. It's not man
right.
caused. It's going
so
to
you,
happen on its own.
That's the exact crux of the anti-Zionistic arguments.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of anti-Zionism, because you might think, how could Jews be anti-Zionists? But that is it. Is the argument isn't, is Israel good or bad? Is it, you know, is it good for the Jews? Is it bad for the Jews now? And it's hard to see it based on now. Before the state, that was the argument. So if people were specifically sending out their students to establish, to bring the redemption, so others would say, absolutely not. How dare you? Who says we have the right to do anything? God didn't call us back to the land yet, and you go sending your students? No way. We're not permitted to do that. So, and I think I mentioned before, I learned from Beryl Wine, that there was a threefold promise, a three-way covenant, right, that the Jews would not try to breach the walls, meaning go back to Israel too early. And the non-Jews wouldn't torture us too much while we were in exile, and God would not allow us to disappear. Hmm. The non-Jews broke their promise.
Yeah, big time.
Right. The non-Jews broke their promise. So the question is, since it's a three-part covenant, are we still bound by our promise to God? Because God kept his promise. We didn't disappear. So are we still not allowed to do that? Or does the breaking of one part of a three-part promise release the others from theirs, right? So it's a legal question. Mm-hmm. So the answer makes a difference as to whether or not you're permitted to go back to Israel to try to start the redemption, or whether you would hold back your people from going to Israel to not try to start the redemption and say that it's wrong to try to push it.
You know what is also very interesting to me is that the Vilna Gaon was basically the head of the Mikhnagdim,
yeah.
And he was against the Hasidim, and the Hasidim were really, you know, full of joy and wanting to, you know, raise the Jewish hopes and hearts during a very dark time and possibly even talk about returning to the land and going there. And yet, here's the Vilna Gaon, you know, many years later, even instituting his own Hasidim to go to the land.
Right. So you have to see it as a little bit broader than that. So just look from our vantage point today of people who understand whatever we understand about Shabbat, right, and how Shabbat does maintain the community, how it is this institution, how it is holiness. And I just heard last night on the BBC, they have a 60-cent recommendation for improving society that they give whenever. I mean, I was driving back from the airport. So the 60-second recommendation was, have your phones be able to read your emotions, whether it's through your feeling your hand temperature or the sweatiness of your palms, being able to detect your hormones, which they'll be able to do soon, and shut down when you're overloaded, mentally overloaded. So you don't get any more emails in and no more calls in until, your phone anyway shuts down when it doesn't have enough memory. But what about your own memory? Maybe you're being overloaded, so it should shut down to give you the space to think, to breathe, and then, you know, you'll go to sleep that night, and then the next day it'll reread you and you'll be able to reconnect. I'm thinking, hello, we have that. It's called Shabbos. We have a prophylactic system in place to prevent people from going on overload because we have a day a week where we disconnect and we get to think. That's the whole point of it. It's a brilliant idea that you're offering. And they said it has to be required by the phones because we don't have the willpower to do it on our own. So it'll just be an automatic function on the phones. I'm like, yes, that's what Shabbos is. It's just an automatic function. You don't have to have the willpower to say, I'm going to rest, I'm going to take some time out. No, it's, you have to do it. Okay, so now let's say there's some people who say, you know, a lot of people really don't get Shabbos and how nice it is. So what I want to do is invite people to a musical celebration of Shabbos. We'll sing, we'll dance, we'll play guitar, we'll have Shabbos unplugged, we'll have Shabbos plugged in, we'll have Friday Night Live. Mm-hmm. It'll be so much fun. Of course people are going to say, no, stop, that's wrong. That's not the way to do Judaism. You can't take out instruments to get people to come for your Shabbos celebration when you're transgressing Shabbos in order to keep Shabbos. Like that's not how you bring people into Shabbos, by transgressing it. That's, in a way, how the Vilna Gaon looked at the Hasidim. And you guys have it all wrong. It's not about singing and dancing and meditating for hours and then transgressing the time of prayer. You can't skip Shema. Shema is supposed to be said by 9:28. And you, with your singing and dancing, is going to make Shema be said at 10:30. That's not Shema. That's just Torah learning. You know, you're just saying a pasuk. You're not keeping the mitzvah of Shema. You guys are wrong. Don't elevate society by casting caution to the winds and halacha to the winds and think that your singing and dancing can replace careful adherence to halacha. So that's the way the Gra saw the Hasidim. Mm-hmm. Today the Hasidim have come more into line with the normative halacha, mm-hmm. but there was that type of thing. So it's not that he came around to their point of view at all. It's that he did see that there was something that maybe you could do to start this ball rolling, and he felt maybe that would be appropriate. That's why the Satmar Rebbe said, no, he didn't see that, and he put his foot down. Mm-hmm. And he was relatively consistent in putting his foot down. I don't know how they are today, but certainly in the beginnings of the state, the Satmars didn't pay in taxes, and they didn't take anything from the state either. Now you can't really do that anymore, because now there's roads and there's electricity, and how can you not take from the state? You drive somewhere and you're taking from the state. You know, there's no way not to. The network is too big. So I don't know how it works today for them. But that was the argument initially. So it's not that the Gra did oppose the Hasidim, but because he saw it like that. That was his perception.
And I like the way it says 1740 parallels the dawn of the sixth day, and we are in 2013 in the Shabbos, pre-Shabbos afternoon of the sixth day.
Yeah.
You know?
We didn't get to that here yet, right? Yeah, no, that's, I mean, that is the concept that we talk about regularly. I guess we'll look at that. And that's one reason why we feel time speeding up. Because anybody who keeps Shabbos knows that Friday morning you sit down for breakfast, no problem. Friday afternoon, maybe you're running a little bit. You don't sit for lunch. You grab it and you're eating whatever you're making, right? But by Erev Shabbos, like it's a mad dash into the showers and hurry up and get the table set and finish up and cover that pot and set up the bluff and whatever it is. It's time speeds up. You're rushing in the end. Pretty much no matter when Shabbos comes in, there's a rush at the end. So we are now Erev Shabbos, and there's a rush. Mm-hmm. And we feel the rush. We can definitely see it in our lifetimes. They're rushing up. So are we up to that? Are we reading that one? Did we get to that? No, I don't think we got to that yet, right? That note.
Which 113?
Yeah,
read 112.
Yeah, so we're not up to that yet.
So the book states that the Gaon, who was exceedingly righteous, received his knowledge through divine inspiration, Ruach HaKodesh, and that he spoke with Eliyahu HaNavi and Yaakov Avinu. Rabbi Chaim of Elazhin, the Gaon's most famous student, also writes this. This also comes from Kol HaTor, page 95. I will tell a tiny bit, as much as we are allowed, about the lofty vision that our teacher, the Gra, saw. He prayed very much with fasting and crying to receive clear advice from heaven. He was answered with a great and holy vision with heavenly revelations, the revelation of Yaakov Avinu. The footnote also brings quotes from the introduction of Rabbi Chaim of Elazhin to the Biurei HaGra on Sifra
the Sinusa.
And from the time that he merited the revelation of Eliyahu, Zichron Livracha, Teledanu, edition page 7, and what Yaakov Avinu and Eliyahu revealed to him, page 20 there. Also, Rabbi Yisrael of Sklov writes in his introduction to Peas HaShulchan, and I saw another secret that Yaakov Avinu revealed to him, to the Gra, about what he had difficulty with in the writings of the Ari.
That's interesting.
Kind of being a little critical there.
Yeah.
Like a cheap
critique. Right.
Huh. So that was the revelation that he needed to get his people over to Israel? Start?
So it doesn't say that right here, but it seems like he did have that understanding that they needed to go and there were certain things to do. That's how he would tell them. You know, what are you supposed to do when you get there? So I don't think it was just sit and learn Torah. I think it was whatever they had to do. And I don't know. I just don't know enough history to know that.
The Gra lived when?
That's a good question. So the Vilna Gaon, does it say in one of these footnotes? 17. He's right around the Hasidic times, so the Hasidim started in the mid-16s, right?
Yeah.
Late 16s, early 17s. So he's got to be right around then. Let's see his years. I think I may have made a chart in the back of the dictionary of famous rabbis and dates and books. But I don't remember if I did or not. I meant to. One of the appendices.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so where are we?
I'd imagine the first thing that people would have to do going there would have to be work the land. I mean,
Right. Well, remember what it was like.
Plant crops. They'd have
it was desert.
Well, you have to remember what it's like. First of all, it was desert. It was all brown. It was not bearing fruit. Second of all, it was very dangerous.
It was brown fruit.
Right. So where did people live?
There.
Well, there's swamps. The swamps are later. I mean, yes, there are swamps. The swamp story is later. So imagine the land, right? So basically, you have Yerushalayim surrounded by a wall that they actually closed.
Midnight.
Nobody lived outside the wall. It was very dangerous to live outside the wall because that's where there's just marauders and listing and all kinds of negative people could do whatever they wanted outside the wall. You're safe inside the city. You're unsafe outside the city. So everybody lived inside the city. There's no agriculture inside the city. Right? So everybody pretty much, I mean, there were, so you did have some Bedouins, whatever, little, you know, sheep herders and stuff like that that went outside the wall. And there was a little agriculture here and there, but not much. People, there were not very many people. And they were largely hungry. It was a sad lot. What did they live off of? The chalukah. The chalukah is the tzedakah gathered by people living outside of Israel to support those Jews who are living in Israel. Mm-hmm. So all of us would have cared about our brethren in Israel. But it's not just about our brethren. It's not like today where we care about Jews living in Israel. That's not it. It's that we understood that there are those people who are holding down the fort for us. Right? Those few Jews who are willing to live in poverty and we're learning Torah, really holding down the fort of the Holy Land. And we gave some money towards that. Now, at that time, none of us had much money. But everybody gave something. That's the chalukah. And then chalukah can also mean lechalek, to divide or to hand out. So that's what people lived off of, was the chalukah in Israel. They lived off of tzedakah, voluntarily given tzedakah from Jews overseas. That's what they lived off of. So Sir Moses Montefiore, right, the whole story of the windmill is as more Jews were coming and as the old city got more crowded and health conditions weren't good and living conditions weren't good, it was not like the old city of today, very pretty. It was really a horrid place to live. It was like living in caves.
Mm-hmm.
So he built the windmill outside the walls. Why? A, to provide some industry, and B, to draw some people out and create a new neighborhood. So I think Mea Shearim was also one of the newer neighborhoods, and the windmill was one of the newer neighborhoods, and that was to draw the Jews out of the city, to expand, to get them out of those overcrowded conditions, to bring some industry to Israel. I'm trying to remember when
that was. Wow. More in the, wasn't it?
That was later.
Little 1800s.
Yes.
Corresponding to the first or second Aliyah.
Yeah.
Of the Jews from Europe, because they built those Roman
probably
houses.
First. Yeah, probably first.
Which are now these very fancy,
yeah,
very expensive.
Mishkanot Sha'ananim.
Right.
Yeah, the
right.
Fancy, expensive. Yeah. Right. I think that was probably the first Aliyah, because it still was early. It was new.
It was
getting the Jews out.
Yeah.
But it did correspond to that. But before that is when people like the Vilna Gaon came over. And so they stayed in Yerushalayim, in Tveria, mm-hmm, and in Tzfat. Right, so that's where those early Jews went. They went to the holy cities. They were walled cities. Mm-hmm. But they went to those enclaves. They weren't just like farming out. They weren't setting up kibbutzim yet. There weren't agricultural collectives yet. Because it wasn't safe. And that's not what they did. But the land was barren, and you can see from Mark Twain's account of his visit to Israel, which I'm sure you've all heard quoted a million times in Discover seminars, but he writes about how he went on a 3-day journey on donkey back from Mount Tabor to Jerusalem, and on the 3-day way that he said the ground was so barren, and this is what I love, this is the one phrase I remember, that imagination couldn't grace it with life.
Mm.
I'm thinking that's Mark Twain.
Right.
And his imagination couldn't grace. That's how barren Israel was, that imagination couldn't grace it with life.
Mm-hmm.
That's how brown it was. So that's what the pioneers came to. So the swamps were a little after that, right? When they came en masse. So that had to do with the
Hula Valley.
So that's all, like, that's the first Aliyah.
Yeah,
that's more like second Aliyah time.
That's
the beginning of the 1900s.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when all the Jews left Russia, as many as they could. So a lot went to America, right? And a lot went to Israel. So the Zionistic ones went to Israel, and the other ones went to America, which is why we had such a casting off in America. We had a big casting off in Israel, too. had a big casting off in America because, well, the ones at least who wanted to build something Jewish, they went to Palestine, right? And the ones who wanted to go to America, they just needed a break. You know, so I don't want to blame them for not wanting to build, but it was a heavy living through those pogroms for decades and just living through misery for so long that they just need to get out from under that. So America was getting out from under it, and Palestine was about building, you know, trying to find a solution to the Jewish problem, which was to become a state. So, and that's part of the complications with Zionism also, is that it was just to become a state. It wasn't to build.
Right.
It wasn't to build the Jewish people. It was to just rescue
sanctuary.
The Jewish...
Yeah.
Yeah, it was to rescue the Jewish people. Yeah.
Okay, the Gaon was told that starting with the year 5500 from the creation, 1740, the powers of the redemption would begin to enter the world. This is because this point in history parallels the dawn of the sixth day of creation, the eve of the Shabbos.
Yeah. You want me to read this one?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. 114. Kol HaTor, page 23. Ikvos Mashicha were opened in the beginning from the first hour of the morning of the sixth day of the sixth, meaning the sixth of the sixth millennium, which is the year 5500 of our sixth millennium, 1740 in the secular counting. And from the second hour, 5542 to 1782, the aspect of all the house of Israel, both the group and each individual in Israel, entered into the Pekida, heavenly remembrance for redemption. Leaf code is to remember something. Of the loftiness of the first Mashiach, Mashiach ben Yosef. So that's when we entered into that time. Also, on page 113, the first Pekida, which began from the beginning of the light of the morning of the sixth century of the sixth millennium, that is to say, 550, or in secular terms, 1740, then it explains that there will be even more messianic powers entering the world from the year 5600, 1840. Saying, and from this year, 5600 onwards, begins the Kol HaTor in the light of our Rabbi the Grah, which grows in strength until the prepared day of redemption. So from 1840, things really started to get cooking. And so we see that's basically, Herzl starts to wake up a little bit around them, because it's in 1848, right, that he makes his prediction, isn't it? Because isn't 100 years later, 1948?
The first Zionist Congress. Yeah, that's around that time.
I thought it was 100 years from his prediction.
Yeah,
maybe I'm wrong.
1850, yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong. But anyway, so, but it does start around then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it'd be good to look up and just learn a little bit. So it does parallel. And in footnote 53 on page 28 of the Yosef Rivlin edition of Kol HaTor, it says, the last generation in the verse, in order that you will tell the last generation, which is a pasuk from Tehillim 48:14, is referring to the period which begins from the year 5500 until the year 5750 of the sixth millennium. That's 1940 to 1990. However, the year 5750 is not mentioned there. So that's just in the footnote, right? But 1990. And we'll probably see that there are shifts from 1990. The footnote is from the editor, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Rivlin, who abridged the original work of his great-grandfather, Rabbi Hillel Shklover. Everything was copied by hand, and some of it was lost. Apparently, what was to be explained about the year 5750 was not completed. The editor, however, left a note to himself with this footnote saying, explain the matter further. That's interesting.
Right.
So, which is appropriate.
Yeah.
We don't need to know everything. You know, I mean, it's interesting to know what we can know, and we also just really have to trust that Hashem runs the world. That's what's the good thing about it.
Mm-hmm.
He's in charge.
That's what Teo was struggling with. The concept that, you know, in our class earlier, that Hashem rules the world, Hashem does everything. And she was, she was talking about, I don't know.
She was talking about when her mother told her to confess.
About confession?
Right, confession.
That's when she she had the thought, or she realized that she doesn't have to confess to him, you know, God already
right.
knows.
But there was something else that she said that just made me think of Hashem. Mm-hmm.
It's just interesting to see how people absorb things at different mm-hmm. times when they're able.
Yes. Because
the same things can be broadcast out. And it really depends on who you are at the moment.
Where you are. Yeah. Holding.
Yeah. To be able to absorb it. Yeah. Yeah. Different things come in at different times. Okay, so now we're back to the text. Where was that? No, 114. Okay, so on this bottom of page 44. You want to keep going?
Everything that will be in the full redemption, he says, enters the world little by little in this period. This messianic potential will become stronger after the year 5600, which is 1840, and between 5600 and 5750, comparable to 1840 to 1990. It will be possible to bring the first stage of the redemption by using this potential properly.
Note 115. These are the main ways of the beginning of the redemption. Done with practical actions by arousal from below, his arusa dilatata, meaning that we arouse the heavenly redemption by doing things here on earth in connection with the redemption. It is a great rule in Ikvos Mashicha that all three main foundations, the tasks to do, the times to do them, and those charged with doing them, need to come together as one, all together, as a threefold thread which is not broken, meaning the deeds, the times, and the emissaries, as alluded to in the verse, the buds are seen in the land, the time of the singing bird has arrived, and the voice of the dove is heard in our land. The buds are seen means the tasks. The time of the singing bird means the times, kol hator. The voice of the dove means the emissaries, meaning that the time for redemption comes according to the desire of Israel in arousal from below, and it is upon us to see and to do as much as in the power of our reason, with the help of the one who gives man reason, according to our rabbis and according to our rabbi the Gra, and with the holy illusions and with all the power of our hand. This idea is repeated constantly throughout the book. So it has to be the right people in the right time doing the right things.
I'm reading the Beryl Wine's book,
Legacy?
The Triumph of Survival. And it starts from 1848, goes up to 1990.
Oh, interesting.
And
probably not for nothing.
When you read about the events and the people and the times that led to the actual creation of the state, it's like everything had to come together.
Oh, totally.
So magically, almost. I hate to use that word, but, you know, it was all ordained.
By Hashgacha Pratis, yeah.
Yeah, it did. It's like that was a miracle.
Totally.
Total miracle.
Totally.
That everything worked.
Yeah.
So that was really, I mean, I think, well, of course, if we're seeing it now with Israel, maybe we just can't see it because we're too close, but that was really the true beginning of the redemption. I think what's happening now from 1990 on is just kind of a dark period.
So it's interesting, because in the shul that I just went to, the Shabbos, they said a prayer that our shul doesn't say. And I wonder about your shul if they do say. Do you know if you go to Aish usually?
Mm-hmm.
Do they bless the state of Israel?
They do.
Right.
They do.
So we don't say that in our shul. And they did say that in this shul. Now, in that prayer, I would be curious to know how Aish says it. Because it says, "Our Avinu shebashamayim berechet medinat Yisrael reshit tzmichat gulatenu." Again, Allah for us, Allah. So, Medinat Yisrael.
Medinat
Yisrael, Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu. That's how the prayer was written. Mm-hmm. Bless the state of Israel, the beginning of the flowering of our redemption. Right? So now, I've been in some places. I was in a to the right of centrist Orthodox, not quite Haredi, but it had Haredi leanings. Synagogue where they said that prayer, but they didn't want to say Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu, qualifying the state of Israel as the beginning of the flowering of our redemption. That's a question. Is it or isn't it? Right? So they added a comma afterwards, Be'ezrat Hashem Yitbarach, right? That it should be the beginning of the flowering of our redemption, God willing, should be good. Right? Now, the synagogue that I went to this Shabbos just said, bless the state of Israel, period, and continued with it. And they didn't qualify it as the beginning of the flowering of our redemption or add that. Right, so they definitely want to bless the state and that God should protect the people who are there, but not qualifying the state as anything.
As the beginning of redemption.
Right. Yeah. So the question is, what is this state? So I think that probably until about 1990, there really was a very strong feeling, at least in the modern Orthodox world, very strong feeling. This is the beginning of the final redemption. You can see it. And in the Zionist camp, you could see it. From about 1990, it's not so clear.
Right.
You know, we're all more nervous. I'm just saying, like, so Lebanon and losing the, start to lose some wars, and we got a little arrogant and a little ahead of ourselves. And I think people are not so clear. Pete, there is more trepidation today. We don't take it for granted that this state is going to be around forever. That, you know, we worry, will it, won't it? You know, like we're still davening for it. It should be, and we're worried about it in a way that we weren't in the mid-80s when things were just kept moving up. Mm-hmm. You know, and now, so, you know, it's sort of like how you feel about your own health. You know, at 20 and 30, you're going to live forever. It's around the bend of 40 where, like, you know, you start to think, huh, things don't work as well as they used to. Yeah, so, who knows? Yeah, Israel's getting a little bit older, so it's not, of course, the physical age, but it's that maybe we have diverted from, we're no longer that idealistic startup where everybody feels the energy of Kedusha. Everybody in the Six-Day War, even the secular Jews, everybody knew it was a miracle. There was no question that it was a miracle. Today, there's a question. Not every secular kid, not every secular 20-year-old will say it was a miracle, but not even every secular 70-year-old is going to say that was a miracle. They lived through it, but they forgot already. We're strong. We're the Israelis. We're an army. We can beat them. Of course we won them. We have superior, you know, surveillance and technology, and of course we won. So I think as we lose some of the connection, we're losing some of the connection. So I think there is it's not as clear as it was where we're headed. And we can't take it for granted. It does have to be an enterprise of Kedusha for it to work. And that's what's so frustrating about the state today is that they don't see it that way. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so all that being said, did we finish this note? Yes, we did. Back to wherever we left off, which was the word properly. Yeah.
Where were we?
We finished 115.
115. Now there's a
so the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon, yeah.
The Vilna Gaon was charged with this task and was instructed in how to do so. He was warned, however, that the forces of evil will rise to fight this plan and will have great power, but will eventually fall before Mashiach ben Yosef.
Yeah, let's finish this paragraph and then...
It is amazing to read this book and to see how the major world changes that occurred in this period, whether social, political, or scientific, were connected to the missions of Mashiach ben Yosef as foretold in Kol HaTor. Which book is she referring to?
So the Kol HaTor is that Vilna Gaon's book.
Oh, this
book. It's amazing to read this book, yeah.
It's also amazing to see that these powers entered the world exactly in the period predicted. Sadly, however, they often reach the world in a negative form, while Mashiach ben Yosef and the redemption have not yet arrived. Again, how are we to understand this?
Right.
So I don't understand the concept of Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. Who is Mashiach ben Yosef?
That's a good question. Is it actually a person?
It's like
is it an age?
The forerunner?
Yeah, it is.
The forerunner of Mashiach ben David.
Yeah.
But, I mean, is it a person?
Right, it's a good question. We definitely understand that Mashiach ben David is a real person.
Right.
An actual person, not an age, not an era.
Right.
I'm not sure if we have that consensus about Mashiach ben Yosef. I just don't know. You know, let's see what he says, 116 on Mashiach ben Yosef. Ibid, page 127. In the Ikvos Mashiach of the sages, that is, both in the times of Ikvos Mashiach and in the actions, both in the times of Ikvos Mashiach, and the actions of Ikvos Mashiach, meaning those things which must be done in the beginning of the redemption, which are the ingathering of the exiles, the building of Jerusalem, the revelation of truth, and Kiddush Hashem, as mentioned above. Then the Sitra Achra, which means literally the other side, but figuratively the forces of evil, will gather strength to disturb and to place obstacles by uprooting the truth and preventing the sanctification of God's name. I would say a strong citra aqua force would be the new atheism.
Right,
yes,
yeah,
there you go.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. About this, it says in Tehillim 89:52, they disgraced the ikvos of your Mashiach. The Sitra Achra wants to uproot the truth and cause Chil Hashem. And we'll fight against it by redeeming the truth and sanctifying God's name. And we must remember that although this power comes miraculously from heaven, still in every matter of a mitzvah, one must begin with arousal from below, that is to say, our own actions. And about it, it says, the truth will sprout from the earth. Also on page 32, Ikvos Mashiach come with disturbances and obstacles from the side of the angel of Esav, and also through Amramlius, the angel of the heir of Rav. But in the end, they fall in the hand of the angel of Yosef, as it says in the Medrash Tanchuma Ki Teitze, with the help of Mashiach ben David, according to the aspect of Yehuda saving Yosef. Whatever that means. But what it does mean is that we bring it closer by keeping Torah truly. That there is a Hisarusa Delatata, the awakening from below, that comes from our careful participation, doing the right things at the right times. Which is one reason why we're careful with the times of tefillah, the times of lighting candles. Like, there's the right time in history, but there's also the right time in the day to do things. Get up on time, and daven on time, and say Shema on time, and on time, do the right things at the right times. That's an important thing.
But it's also interesting that, you know, as it, and I've heard this many times before, as the time comes closer and closer, the forces of evil will become stronger and stronger.
Yeah.
And, you know, we see that.
Look all around,
The rise of Islamic fundamentalism and the rate of intermarriage and, you know, all that stuff is just surrounding us now.
Right.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. I would even say the liberal quest to include Muslims in creating a three Abrahamic faiths thing is all part of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's all part of
legitimacy to something that's really
that's not, right.
That's not.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's all part of it. All of a piece. Mm. Great. Okay.
So good.
We'll continue.
So swallow powers next time.
Yeah.